Tech Talk with Jess Kelly. This is News Talk.
You're very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up this week, Luca Fuelon has the beginner's guide to buying a drone. WIT tells us about Ireland's first eSports scholarship, and in just a moment we'll find out about Generative Pre-trained Transformer 3, the artificial intelligence you really should know about. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Twitter at JessKellyNT. Now, I mentioned it there, but GPT-3 is a form of artificial intelligence that looks set to change how things are done. But as with all types of AI, there are good sides and there are bad sides. I'm joined now by Hesham Shorkey, who is the head of AI engineering at EY. Hesham, thank you for your time. You might just start by giving us a bit of an overview, a bit of an introduction. What exactly is GPT-3?
Well, GPT-3 is technically a large model. It's a large neural network model, and it's basically a platform. It created a new platform for AI, for an AI assistant that you don't need to write code for or even do a data science work for. So it's basically it's a specific type of technology in terms of AI neural networks. It's, for example, it doesn't process images, it doesn't produce images. It's only about text. So it's a language model. And that's what GPT-3, there was predecessors to the same, but this time it's much larger. So the new thing about GPT-3, it's much larger than any probably existing model in the similar technology.
So GPT, for those who don't know, stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer. And what I've read about this and what I've heard about this is that it's kind of as close to outsmarting us as AI has got in terms of language skills, in terms of, you know, preempting elements of creativity, because some people would say that AI will never be able to write a song or a poem, for example. But I have seen examples of GPT-3 where that has happened.
Well, that's correct to some extent. First of all, GPT-3, it's not perfect. It's the model is huge, and it includes has been trained, I mean, on the whole Wikipedia, on another big data set called Common Crawl. And it's there's 500 gigabytes of text included, one probably more trillion words. And in terms of neural network design, it includes 175 billion parameters, billion by B. So it's a huge number of parameters for a network. And it's 100 times larger than its predecessors. So now, having said that, this is the advantage of and the key advantage of GPT-3. So outsmarting humans, it's not perfect yet, but people use it not necessarily for creativity. People use it to generate, let's say, some bloggers when they want to write a new blog and they want to look for inspirations. Some people started as a use case to use GPT-3 to through maybe a couple of paragraphs of their own writings and a few words. So, and it generates maybe a handful of other paragraphs to give them of their own style or writing style. So it gives them inspiration. But the key thing about it as well, in terms of the end user, it helps the end user to understand and accelerate the awareness of what the possibilities of AI could be.
Yeah, and this is where it gets interesting, because conversations around AI can't really happen without going down the road of ethics and the what-if scenarios. So the blogger example is a good one, because that shows a time-saving aspect. It shows, you know, it's just a sort of almost like an assistant. It is definitely an assistant in that regard. But when it comes to the ethics question, will we get to a stage where, if this type of content were to go everywhere in mainstream, if bloggers were to start using it, do you think that we would have to have, you know, little disclaimers stating that this has been composed or partly composed by an AI?
Oh, totally agree. And I'm happy that the owners of or the developers of GPT-3, they allowed people only to invite. So you have to apply. I personally applied to get access to the API and use it. So at least to identify who has access to it. And there's like a bunch of malicious use cases using GPT-3. Like think about when it comes to digital content. Let's say the authorship, the academic reviews, and the copyright laws, and we think also about the thing that people always it comes to mind when you think about AI in terms of biases. So GPT-3 is trained on our own knowledge that we produced and stored on the internet, which means it has all our biases collectively.
Mm-hmm.
And so there must be. I mean, we can't. Trust the just out of the box, the content that generated by the model. So until these biases are sufficiently mitigated, so the output must be challenged and kind of it considered. It's not something you can consider to be consumed directly by society. And I can easily talk about fake news and biases in terms of gender and qualities like gender and color, etc. So I don't think it's a model that everybody could use. And again, I'm happy that the developers just made it by invite rather than just put it on the public.
Yeah, because people might remember a few years ago there was a chatbot named Taylor put up on Twitter, and you could go up and have a conversation with it. And it seemed really cool to begin with because you were having a conversation with this, you know, non-human form. But then people being people started to manipulate it. And so if I typed in Jess Kelly is the worst person that ever existed, the next time somebody typed in my name, the bot would then reply with she's the worst person that ever existed. And so we saw computers and computing bullying people, which is obviously not what we want. So this is a tool that can be weaponized. I know it sounds dramatic, but that is true, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And when it comes to content, people normally write and read content generally. So people skim over and probably get the context. And given the quality of the output from these models, many people, I myself got saved a couple of times in the past couple of weeks about articles that have been written by, generated, I'd say, by GPT, not written. And yes, it is made to be trained from our own knowledge, and it can be weaponized. And I'm talking about the mainstream news here, and it could generate fake news, could generate articles that has no authorship. So instead of writing academic articles, people could use it to generate. And think about conferences and the peer review, how people spend their time reviewing articles that supposed to come from a proper academic writings, and it's actually generated by a model. It's huge. The malicious use cases is huge. But at the same time, we just want to look at the positive side. It's for consumers, for businesses, and it allows people to. It just brings AI to everybody's laptop if used properly. And I'm talking about automation and really assistance here. It could take lots of automated and automatable and boring type of tasks off our table. And I believe the creativity as well, and it kind of democratize access to technical understanding. Think about what programming language and development has been in the last, let's say, 30 years ago, and what it is now. Some of it, like much of it, is could be used as developed as drag and drop. But we need to understand as well, there is a huge effort and insanely complex structures behind GPT-3. So even though it's simple to use, but actually it's behind it, there is a complex structure that we still need our data scientists to work a little bit more to train it on and to improve the quality of the training material it takes.
This could be a stupid question now, but does that mean that the value of coding, because for years now, everyone has been told just to learn to code because it's the future and so on. Does this negate the need for coding as a whole?
No.
Okay.
It's a funny topic because it's actually what had like a number of threads on Twitter in the last few days In development and in software engineering, there are lots of, like, it's a spectrum of where you can have these kinds of simple logic,
mm-hmm.
and the other side you have some systematic work, and a typical developer probably will do both. But definitely GPT-3 can help in automating, let's say, generating some of the web pages, but it can't develop a web application. It can do a business analysis. Again, the automation piece in every job, almost every job, there is a piece that can be automated. And this is where the likes of GPT models can fit.
We have been talking a lot on the show and my other program, Future of Work, about the future of work. Imagine that. And one thing that I've noticed over the last few months is how my inbox is forever full. Even if I set time aside to try and tackle it and so on, I just never get on top of it. And so for me, I would love to have something like GPT-3 that could just take over that entirely and fill my calendar. That's what I'm living for, is a smart artificial intelligence application that would completely take over my inbox, completely manage my calendar, but not insult anybody in the process of trying to automate emails, that type of thing. Is that a practical application for this technology?
Alfred, it's not as you exactly describe it. It's a little bit, it still requires you to assign, let's say, these types of emails. Let's say news emails, summarize the news emails for me. Write emails to reply to all calendars coming from my friends, let's say, that prioritize this for everything else and reply nicely that I'll attend.
Okay, so it's a bit like if this, then that. You have to tell it what you want to do in certain scenarios and then it'll do it.
No, you just give it a few examples.
Uh-huh.
You don't have to go for if statements or if else, because this is endless. You can't give everything, but you give it a bit of context. And the real huge advantage of, and the jump that GPT-3 has done, because we have had these models before, you have a model and you train the model with examples and the model works. But the problem is you have to give it thousands of examples, where in case in GPT-3, you don't have to give it thousands of examples. You just need to give it like a bunch of examples. And again, this is the breakthrough with GPT-3. But again, no, you can't. I mean, this application, as you described it, Jess, is not there yet. I wouldn't do that for my inbox, I'd say.
Okay. I'll just be more patient then, I suppose. In terms of the company that's behind this technology, because, you know, just this week we're seeing the CEOs of the four big tech companies before the US Congress answering to the antitrust hearing. So trust, and, you know, ensuring that our information is being used in the way it should be and the way we consent to and all that is front and center of our minds. What do we know about the company behind it, and how do we ensure that the company don't almost, you know, in a few years' time, to make more money, utilize it in a way that actually damages us, the consumer?
Well, for the organization behind it, it's OpenAI. And there are a bunch of well-known entrepreneurs and investors behind it, like prominently Elon Musk,
mm-hmm.
Peter Thiel. So I think it's in good hands, if I may say. The organization is well known they are advocates for ethical AI and non-malicious AI use cases. So at the front page, I think it's the organization has a good reputation. But my fear is currently we give it by invite. And this won't give the scale that we were looking for such models. And I believe it's not about the company and the organization behind it. I believe it's about the regulation. So there is a statement about ethical AI has been issued in Europe here. I haven't seen such a statement in the States yet. Probably it has been done, but by other non-profit organizations. So I believe the way we go is, given what GPT-3 can really provide, and I believe there will be more like GPT-3 in future, we need to set that at the regulatory level and not really leave it to different organizations, which they are doing good and they are doing okay. But there will be cases where this can, you know, slip in the cracks, and we won't be able to. We will find like malicious use cases of using these models. So yes, the organization is great. It has a huge reputation, great entrepreneurs behind it, but the regulation has to be in place.
Do you, like, I know there will be people listening to this now who instantly will have their backs up and they will say, I don't want this. I don't like the sound of it. We don't need it as such. Is this inevitable that it's coming down the tracks? And again, it's one of those things that in a few years' time, you'll blink and it'll be everywhere.
Yes, as you said, it's in a few years' time. And the thing that people probably won't realize about AI, last year, if you talked to me about this capability, I would say, well, it's kind of 5-7 years down the line.
Mm.
And if you talk to me this year, I'd say less. And so the growth is exponential. The expectations are getting higher and higher with more models are injected into the community. The key thing about us as general public to think about is, as like number one, we need to be careful of whatever we get from these models. You will be reading news that you won't really realize if they are real news or fake news. And that happened, but it just gets better and better. The second thing about our this is the thing about future of work. People think that there is kind of two paranoid spectrum, the two sides of the spectrum about the future of work with the AI and with these models. I believe it's not going to get close to human intelligence. And looking at the curve, no, it's linear. So we constantly get to the conclusion it's not getting close, but it's hugely improving the quality of the automation that we see. So we saw earlier that you need to intervene. Humans need to intervene a lot to do some automation tasks in the last few years. But today, they don't. There are loads of tasks that this can be automated. And in terms of education, in terms of data analysis, it's very helpful. It's not going to take all the jobs, but it will take some jobs. And it's kind of proving every year that more and more we need to move to the areas where AI won't help. And there are areas that AI won't help, and this we just need to focus on that.
Well, look, I have a feeling we'll be talking about this again at some stage in the near future. But for the moment, Hesham Chokri from EY, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. As always, you can contact the show on Twitter at JessKellyNT, or you can drop us an email at techtalk@newstalk.com is the email address. And we're going to turn our attention to something that I don't think I've ever spoken about in depth on this show, and that is drones. And I know that there are many, many enthusiasts out there who swear by them. I know Adrian Weckler in the Irish Independent has stunning, like, should be on Fáilte Ireland campaigns, quality videos on his Instagram and his Twitter constantly. I bought myself one at Christmas and I broke off one of the little, I was going to call it a twisty bit, but I know it's a propeller, within a matter of days. So I am not the person to go to, but I'm delighted to be joined by broadcaster and drone enthusiast, Luke O'Foylon. Luke, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jess. I'm happy to be part of this drone exclusive for Tech Talk.
I know, it's a big deal. So I know that you have gone out and you have bought different drones. You've gone for smaller ones, you've gone for bigger ones, you've customized them. But what I wanted to start with at the most basic level is, like, what constitutes a good drone? And, you know, what kind of money are we talking about for the people who want to go out and have the crack rather than shooting, you know, big ad campaigns and so on?
Yeah. Okay. Well, mainly the main producer of drones is a company called DJI, which is an American company. And they're basically the go-to company. I mean, there's other places you could go, but the quality is always going to be subpar. These are really, really well produced, well researched, well manufactured drones, and they come in all different shapes and sizes and all different price points. So your basic one, and this is for somebody who literally just would like to go out and shoot some footage that looks pretty cool, that's high def, that they could play on a TV screen or a YouTube channel, and just it'd be really good quality, and that's the Mavic Mini, and that comes in at about €400.
Okay. So that is like, and let's be real for a minute, because I would always say, even when it comes to phones, anything over €150 is a lot of money. So 400 yeah. quid out of the box is quite expensive. The reason I wanted a drone, for example, is my niece and my nephew have learned to ride their bikes. And so I wanted to get the drone going above them, cycling their bikes. That it's basically a fancy family video recorder is what I wanted. But 400 quid, and you're saying that would tick a lot of the boxes.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing about the Mini is it's as light as a smartphone. It's really, really light. It's 249 grams. And the reason why it's that light is because in America, the limit that you have, unless you have to register your drone, is 250 grams. So anything above that, you need to register. So DJI very sneakily made their drone 249. So just a little gram under. So this is light. I mean, it comes with guards as well in the propeller. So if it was to crash into you, for instance, it wouldn't really do anything. You wouldn't break a window. You wouldn't hurt anybody as long as you had the guards on. It has a flight time of about 30 minutes. And it's got good footage, and it's nice and simple. It's got a basic camera. So that's your basic entry level setup that I would recommend.
You mentioned the weight there, and when I got my one, and I can't remember the brand, it was kind of a Mickey Mouse one that cost me about 80 quid on Amazon, and it was so light that any sort of, not even a gust of wind, I'm yeah. talking about if I went, it just went in the opposite direction. So is that a problem with this one as well?
It would be more of a problem than the other drones. They are all affected by wind. It's got this cool little axis gimbal here that moves whenever you move, kind of like when you hold a chicken's body and you move it, but the head doesn't move. Do you ever see those videos? It's kind of the same.
No, Luke, I haven't seen those videos, and I am not familiar with that analogy, but thank you for bringing that to my show. Okay, so that is something to consider. In terms of the battery life, again, flight time of 30 minutes isn't bad going for a device of this size. Does it come with a spare battery?
Well, you can get the Flymore combo for about €100, and you get two extra batteries, a few more propellers, and a few bits. Like all of the drones that we're going to be talking about today have Flymore combos attached to them. So the €400 is really just for a battery, the drone, a controller, and a few like bits, charging bits, and maybe one set of extra propellers.
Okay.
You pay the extra for the more of the combo.
And in terms of getting the footage off the drone, is it that it pairs to your phone via an app and the footage goes across that way, or how does it work?
So you can do it two different ways. One is attached to your phone. It'll send 1080p video to save to your phone. And the other then is you can just take out the micro SD card, plug it into your laptop, and you can get the full 4K footage. And all of the drones do that. So it's handy if for some reason you were to lose the drone and the SD card, you still have the footage on your phone.
Okay. Well, that does sound like a good option. Again, we acknowledge the €400 is a bit of money, but I wasted 80 quid by buying my Mickey Mouse when I would have been better off just going for something like this. What's the step up? And again, talk us through the money and the difference in terms of the spec.
Right. So let's say you bought the Mini, you had it for a year and you got loads of great footage, but you sort of wanted to mess around with your video and photos more. You wanted more of a flight time. You wanted to go further away. You'd go for the Mavic Air 2. So this is the drone that I have, and it is almost perfect. I mean, I've had this for 6-7 months now, and I can't fault it. I really can't. So this has got 4K footage. It's got super slow motion, amazing pictures. It's got a 34-minute flight time. You can fly 10 kilometers away. Not that you would, but we'll get into that later. And it's got upgraded software, so it can track you, like if you're going to track your cousins as they're on their bikes, and for some reason they go in front of a tree. The drone will recognize the tree. It won't just freak out and go, I can't find them anymore. It'll just keep going and it'll course correct itself to find them, and then it'll track them safely. So it's got lots of sensors. It won't crash into trees. And it's got a really bright light underneath it as well.
And how much are we talking for that one?
So that is €849 for the basic package. And then the Flymore combo is about €200 extra.
Oh, that's a big jump, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's really worth it. I mean, the Mavic Air 2 is for, I mean, you could go to Fulge Ireland with the footage that you could go from Discovery. You can go to anybody. This is almost like industry grade color correction, industry grade video. It is almost, like I said, almost a perfect drone.
Okay. And in terms of, is it any easier to fly because it's that bit fancier? Because again, talking about my crappy one, I found it really, maybe I'm just a dope, but I found it kind of difficult to fly and to control and all the rest. Is this any better? Is the user experience any better, or is all the technology and all the value in the body of the drone?
Well, you've got the sensors on the bottom and the sides and the front. So if you try and crash into a house or a tree, it won't let you. It'll just stop way before it. So that's really helpful. It doesn't have sensors on the sides, however. So if for some reason you were going sideways, you'd crash straight into something. So that's something you have to pay a little extra for in the other drones. But in terms of the feel of the drone when you're flying it, I've flown this at the top of Kropatrick, which it was really windy and it was absolutely fine.
Wow. Okay. and so would this be your go-to one then?
Yeah, this is the one I was waiting for. The Mavic Air was the one before this. I had that too. I had two of them actually. Three of them, sorry, I crashed two. And I loved it, but I wanted something with longer battery life and something that go a little bit farther away. So when this Mavic Air 2 came out, I think I was one of the first people in Ireland to get it.
You know, I know you love your drones. Is it worth, do you think, you know, if someone gets this and if they go for the two and if it's the one that, you know, you're recommending, is it definitely worth getting the combo pack to get the extra bits and pieces? Or would you say start off small and then go back and purchase if you need it?
Well, if you're getting the Mavic Air 2, you're already, I would hope you're already quite experienced. I would hope that you had, it's kind of like a first car. I mean, you don't go out and buy a BMW for your first car. You go out and buy something small, a Golf or Polo or something like that. And because you're most likely maybe going to get into a small fender bender, or maybe you just want to get comfortable driving an actual car. It's the exact same with drones. So let's just say you had your time with the Mini or whatever you got and you wanted to upgrade to the Air 2. I would advise you to get the Flymore pack purely because you're going to have more time in the air. So three batteries, around a half an hour each, that is a lot of time to get the footage that you're trying to get. And if you have that drone, the footage you're getting is almost professional. It's you're going to want to be in the air as long as possible.
In terms of calling it back, so you know if it does go out of sight, can you tell us all from my personal experience? Does it kind of come back to home, or do you have to be able to see, does it have to be in your eyeline the whole time is my question?
Legally, yes, you can fly further than a certain distance and you can fly where you can't see it. You must always have a line of sight with the drone. But the Mavic Air 2 will go 10 kilometers away if you so order to do so. But when it takes off, it automatically, with GPS, recognizes where it took off from and it'll land exactly, like literally millimeter to that spot, even in windy conditions. And also if the battery goes below a certain point, it'll freak out and completely lock you out of the control and it'll fly back to that point as well.
Okay, so it's smarter than me, which is great. That's exactly what I want from this. Is there a level above that? And if so, what kind of money are we talking?
So now we're into the, let's just say you had the small car, and then you had a BMW, and then you had a midlife crisis, and you thought, geez, it'd be great to get a Porsche. This would be the Porsche. So this is the Mavic 2 Pro or the Mavic 2 Zoom. They're both roughly the same drone, but attached to it. So the Mavic 2 Pro has an upgraded camera, and the Mavic 2 Zoom has the ability to zoom, but a slightly downgraded camera. So they come in at €1,500 for the Pro and €1,249 for the Zoom.
Janie Mac, and what do they do that's worth that money?
So this would be this is sort of it's hard to describe. This is like for those who are not just the enthusiasts, but they're like, I'm a nerd about it. So like they're really nerdy about their color grading and their processing speed, and they want to go in and fine tune the exposure level, and it really goes into the sort of nerd bracket of drones. I mean, like if I had the money, I'd buy the Mavic 2 Pro, but I talk myself out of it because the Mavic Air 2 actually has a similar flight time kind of similar photos, and in fact it has some of the options that are better than the 2 Pro, but this is like the one you want, for instance. This is the one you drive by and you see in the shops and go, oh, I would love that.
But this sounds like it's more at professionals or like the long time hobbyists who've saved up for a good while to try, like to justify it almost, that they've kind of gotten all they can get from the Air to upgrade to this. So is it more that there's no other benefits? Is the device itself, does it look similar? Does it have those extra sensors on the side that you were mentioning, that kind of stuff?
It does, actually. That's, so when I was sort of humming and hawing about which one I was going to get, I looked at the sensors in hindsight, I probably should have gotten the Mavic 2 Pro, because the way I fly my drone, I like to get nice, cool shots of flying through trees and that. And it'd be nice to have sideways sensors. The more I fly it, the more I'm like, no, I can't go sideways through there. So the Mavic 2 Pro would give you that. It also, there is a slight downside as well. For instance, if you go out and buy the Mavic 2 Pro and you get all this lovely 4K footage, you need a pretty good computer to edit the footage, because it comes in big, big chunks. And I've tried to edit some of the footage that is similar to what comes out of the Mavic 2 Pro, and my laptop wouldn't do it. It literally was just freeze framing the whole time. So that's something you like, if you're going for the Mavic 2 Pro, you already have a pretty decent laptop, and you probably fly drones more as a business as opposed to as an enthusiast.
Okay, well, let's go back to the Air 2 then, because that does sound like this is the one that's around €800, and it sounds like it ticks most of the boxes. When you're going out to buy, where do you buy them? Are there questions you should ask, or is it research that you do beforehand? Like, what do you need to know going into a store to buy one of these?
Well, you'd buy it online from DJI Store. So it gets flown over from America, China, probably China, actually. And so it's very similar to the Apple Store. It's all white background. You go into the DJI Store, which you can go to DJI.com, and there's every single drone you could ever want, from drones that have flashlights on them to speakers to huge these very, very heavy drones that you obviously need more of a license to pilot. And then the very, very small ones like the Mini. So it's very easy, very well laid out, and it goes through all the specs. It's literally just like buying an iPhone.
Okay. And in terms, because I'm looking here, I see Harvey Norman also sells the Mavic Air 2 as well. They have it for €849. Why DJI? Because I know the name. Again, I've never owned one of their products. So why these guys over, any of the other? I couldn't even name another drone company if you asked me to.
Well, there's some, but even some of the drone companies use DJI innards, like they use their processor and things like that. So really, it's DJI you're going to go for. You'd probably go with them as opposed to somewhere like Harvey Norman, is because you can buy care packages with DJI. I'm not sure if you can do that with other retailers. And the care package would be sort of like an insurance. So I've used these twice because two of my drones have taken a bit of a swim. And if you have the care package, which I believe is €80 to €100, it's quite small, and it lasts for quite a while. If you were to, for instance, drop it in the water, all that would happen is that you send the drone back. You have to get it back. You can't just let it float away. You have to get it back, and you have to send it away to Norway, and they'll have a look at it, and you say, yeah, I dropped it in a river, and they say, okay, we'll charge you a certain amount. It won't be for the full amount of the drone, and we'll send you a brand new drone back.
Okay, cool. So that does sound like it's worth it, so.
Yeah. Oh, every drone I've gotten the care package, and I've used it twice.
Okay. In terms then of the regulations, and you mentioned licensing and stuff like that, where do we stand? And let's go back to being a novice or a hobbyist rather than a professional.
Yeah, so this is where it gets interesting, because there's lots of different laws depending on the country you're in. So yeah, let's say you are a person who wants to get into this, and he or she buys the Mavic Mini, for instance, that we talked about at the start. You're fine. You don't have to register that drone. You don't have to do anything with that drone, really. It's under the weight limit. So the IAA, which is the sort of governing body, and they have this order called the Small Unmanned Aircraft and Rockets Order. And so if you're 1 kg or more, or less than 25 kg, you have to be registered. But sure, the Mavic Mini is well below that, and so is the Mavic Air 2, so you don't have to register at all. You can just go out and buy one.
Okay. You mentioned there about the distances and all the rest. Like, is it just that you have to be honest about it and you don't want to get ratted out? That's how it's governed, or is it heavily policed?
That's a good question. And this is now where we're going to kind of go into a gray area, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I know that I'll try and be as honest as possible here. So first of all, you have to be over 16 years of age to register a drone. So if you were to get into it, you would have to, and if it was of a certain weight, like for instance, the Phantom, which we didn't really talk about, but it's basically just another upgrade from the Mavic 2 Pro. That is over the limit. That's 1.2 kg. So if for some reason you got that, you'd have to register. And you do that by going to the IAA. Then you have to go on a training course, which is online, and they range from about €650 and upwards. And there's a few different places around the country that will do that. And then you really get into the nitty gritty where you can't fly further away than 300 meters. You can't fly within 30 meters of any person or a vehicle or a ship or a structure. Mm-hmm. You can never fly it outside your line of sight. And you can't go above 400 feet above ground level or in built up urban areas. So they're really the main rules that you have to follow if you are going to get into the sort of higher grade and more weight. For some reason, I think it goes by weight, because if it fell out of the sky, would it hurt you, or would it affect a ship or a plane or something like that, which I suppose is fair.
We have spoken on this program to Bobby Healy of Mana Drones, and he is the guy behind the company that is looking to use drones for food delivery. They were looking at using drones for, you know, medical delivery. Do you see the benefits beyond getting your class footage that looks brilliant on your Instagram? Do you see the benefits and the potential for drones for those kind of uses?
The problem isn't with the drones. The problem is with people. I think it's the same sort of thing that's holding the Tesla autopilot system back. You know, you can design the best technology and manufacture these amazing drones which will never fall out of the sky, and they won't go near other aircraft, and then you get some dope with a slingshot who's going to hit it out of the sky. I mean, the same thing that happened with the autopilot, where, you know, a person can literally just walk into the car as it's perfectly fine. Someone can mess with a drone while it's delivering whatever it is it's delivering. I think it's the future. I mean, it's only a matter of time, I'm sure, when people suggested that we should fly in aircraft, other people said that's ridiculous. We'll only ever use a horse. So the same thing is kind of happening here. It's so far out, and drones have such a bad name for themselves. I think there's definitely a stigma with, you know, some of the pilots out there that, you know, fly next to airplanes, and all the airplanes are grounded for hours because they think the drone is still there. I mean, that's 100% understandable that there's such a stigma. So when someone suggests that you use it for medical supplies or food, there's obviously going to be a backlash of people say, oh no, that's never going to work. So I hope it will work. You know, I'm positive that in time we will see a lot more drones delivering things. It's just the safety standards and trying to educate people that will make that possible, I think.
One thing we didn't touch upon, actually, is the privacy side of drones. And I know that that's something when we spoke to Bobby the last time, people were concerned about, because his drones don't use cameras, as in they're not recording footage or people or anything like that. It's more just from a tracking point of view and the GPS side of things. Have you encountered any issues when you've had your drones out of people asking what you're using the footage for or anything like that?
It's weird because we're both on Twitter, Jess, right? And I think we kind of see a real condensed view on something and a real loud view on something in a big thread, for instance, a lot of people talking about the same thing. And I've seen so many threads about drones and about how awful they are and about how such and such a person hates them and such a person saw one peeping in a window and all this thing. But personally, and I can't lie, personally, most of my drone experience with people asking me questions have been overwhelmingly positive. People asking where I got it, how much it was, can they see it fly? They're showing their kids what I can see up really high or whatever it is. And I've actually never had a negative in the years I've been doing it, a negative interaction with someone who thought that maybe, I don't know, I was looking at them when, in fact, I'm pointing the wrong direction. But I can understand. I mean, you hear this buzzing kind of noise. You know, what is, you know, you look up and you see this thing and you automatically think camera. You know, you automatically think flying camera. And I might be doing some time lapse of a river, you know, and I'm not even pointing in your direction. So I can understand, you know, people, you know, their privacy. But for the most part, people have been really overwhelmingly curious and want to know where they can get one.
So it's an expensive hobby, but as a hobby, you'd recommend it?
See, it can it has a knock-on effect, you see. What happens is you buy the drone, you go, oh, I wonder why I'll fly this. And then you start looking up places and you go, oh, that'd be lovely. And so you take a trip there and you might hike up a mountain or you might go find this cool spot that you can't get to unless you have a drone. Like I've gone on holidays with this drone and I'll Google places to go and get this really cool footage of, like, you know, old bridges or whatever it is. So it sort of gets you out and about, and it gets you thinking of, you know, where can I go today, or how can I make the most of this trip, you know? And so it kind of has that nice knock-on effect, I've found.
I know also just from your Instagram, you've been working around or playing around with, you know, the likes of Photoshop and video grading and all the rest. Is that a knock-on effect from using the drone as well?
Yeah, that's an upskill. So I do freelance videography, and I had I'd done that with a normal camera for years. And then when I started investing in drones, you start to realize you can get these really cool, unique perspectives on property or, you know, whatever it is, a hotel or an event, using a drone. And then from that, you sort of learn how to edit, and then you want your footage to look better, so you learn how to color grade, and you just sort of upskill naturally just by wanting to get better. So that's definitely been another great positive of spending long hours in my bedroom on my laptop photoshopping the smallest details that no one is noticing, but I'm like, yeah, that is definitely a difference there.
Well, no, because some of the bits I've seen look great. If you want to have a look at them, you'll find Luke on Instagram. Just search for Luke O'Fuelon. Luke, thank you very much for talking us through that guide. That was broadcaster, journalist and drone enthusiast, Luke O'Fuelon. Luke, thank you so much.
Cheers, Jess.
Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
TechTalk at newstalk.com is the email address if you want to get in touch. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. A few weeks ago, we heard from Munster Rugby about their venture into the world of esports. And this week, we had further news from the world of gaming. Waterford IT has announced Ireland's first esports scholarship. And delighted to be joined now by John Windle, the head of WIT Viking Sport, to find out more. John, welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit more about what you've announced this week.
Yeah, I suppose we're developing our first esports scholarship. So it's unique, as in it's the first in Ireland. And I suppose its background, I suppose, comes from a few different elements that we've just seen emerging trends of esports. We know from the stats there that there's a lot of our target audience, which is the students that we hope to come to WIT, are playing esports. I suppose that's where it's developed from, and I suppose from that then we've linked in, I suppose, with the kind of the experts in Ireland, let's say, which is Collegiate Esport Ireland and Ireland Esports, which are the governing body for esports in Ireland, on how best to set up an esports scholarship. So we've taken their direction and criteria from them. I suppose that's the development stages of it, and into what it is now, I suppose, an offer out to students, both students that are in the college now and new students come in to be able to apply for the scholarship.
This must be great news for parents listening to this now, thinking, geez, the computer games is the reason I was worried my child mightn't get into college, and now there's a scholarship being made available. So can you give me an overview of the criteria that is in place to ensure that it's not just, you know, avid gamers who can avail of it? I assume there's kind of a broad spectrum of things that you'd have to comply with.
Yeah, I suppose so. Ireland Esports, we've had a criteria committee. So Ireland Esports would have set out the criteria for the esports. So they would have had to compete at a nationally or international level at competitions to achieve the esports scholarship. So at the moment, we've five different sports within it. And then the five different sports, I suppose, esports is unique. It's kind of a broad title, but there is different sports within esports. So to qualify for our one, you would have to compete at a national or international level in League of Legends, Valorant, Counter-Strike, Rocket League, or FIFA 20. So they're the five sports that we have scholarships in, and to qualify for that, you would have to have competed in an international competition that we would have set out, I suppose. So there are clear guidelines on our website, I suppose, for any parents or prospective students that are interested to see if they would qualify for the esports scholarship.
And where does the academic requirements come into it?
So it's still the same academic requirement, as in you still have to get your points to get your course, the same as any other scholarship that we have. But I suppose the support around that once you get the scholarship, some of it are financial supports, some of it is academic support whilst you're a student here, such as grinds, additional grinds for our student scholarship athletes. All the other facilities that a normal sports scholarship would get, such as access to training facilities, access to sports psychology, access to nutrition, physiotherapy, all the usual high-performance benefits that go to other sports will now also go to esports.
And I know you said that, you know, you were looking at your target demographic and the students that you hope will come to WIT, but what does WIT get from this? And, you know, is it that you see that this area is emerging and there is, you know, money to be made, careers to be had in this esports arena?
Yeah, I suppose there's a number of things, I suppose. One, there's 700,000, and sometimes I even get a fright when I hear the number, 700,000 esports or gamers playing in Ireland regularly. And it's 200,000 Fortnite players. So definitely the audience is there, especially among the younger demographic. But I suppose we also have, if there's children out there or young students, young adults, and this is what they want to do, we want to provide a community that supports that within WIT. So it's not only, I suppose, a recruitment tool, it's also providing a place and a community for people when they're in college to make friends, like every other sport and every other activity, you know, such as societies as well, that you have a place that you might find people with similar interests, and it helps the whole college experience.
With other sporting scholarships, you know, you would be part of a team, you'd have your training process and programs. You mentioned there about, you know, things like physiotherapy, nutrition. Have you guys got the facilities to offer that for esports stars? Because I imagine it's quite different to anyone playing, you know, rugby or lacrosse or whatever.
It is, yeah. No, I suppose, and it's funny because I listened to Sport for Business had a podcast with Munster Rugby, who've also launched their esports team. And they are trying to bring their high performance values that they have for their team, because they're high performance experts, and they're trying to bring that over to esports. And we're trying to bring the same values over to esports as well, because most of the professional esports players that are out there, they're training physically as well as gaming. So everybody just thinks, you know, it could be sedentary, but it's not. They're fit players. They're playing for a long period of time. Their reactions have to be quick. So we have to provide all the things for that. So once again, coaching, dedicated kind of gaming rooms, and all that will be in place for the students. Now, it's like we were saying on the launch, it's going to be a slow build-up. You know, this is the foundation time of it, because it will take a lot. You know, there's teams. You could have one player who's a brilliant League of Legends player, and you can have another player who's a brilliant Valorant player. It doesn't mean you exactly have a team, because they're great at individual sports. So this will be a 5 or 6 year development.
And stamina is a big thing that is in, you know, across both traditional sports and then esports as well. So the mental training and the development of that sort of stamina is vital, I'd imagine.
Yeah. Like it's focus, and I suppose for a lot of people, just to translate it, we all know how fit Formula One drivers have become, because how mentally switched on they have to be for the duration of the time they're out on the track. And esports is no different. There's a lot of time you can't mentally fatigue at any time, and mental fatigue is linked in with physical fitness as well. So they're all locked in. We also have sports psychology on offer that will all, I suppose, help you tailor-made for their sport.
And how are you going to not market it, but get the word out there? Obviously, you had your launch earlier the week. This week, you're talking to me. But how will you get the word out there so people know that this is a serious offering that's out there for students that they can avail of and take their hobby and their passion and make it into something that ties into academia, but also then as a career?
Yeah, well, I suppose all the criteria will be on that. The WIT page, I suppose, the offerings and everything that go with it, the support offerings that we will give to the students coming in as well. But it's also a collaboration. We have our computers department, we have our online learning department. They're all heavily involved in esports, and they're advising us, and they're helping us, because I'm not an expert in esports, but they are the experts in esports, and they're kind of helping us make sure that we have both the academic supports and the sporting supports to kind of give that environment that'll benefit esports players. Like, the main goal for this is that all of our students to leave after 4 years with their degree or push on to their masters or whatever. But our main goal is just provide a great environment for them when they're here, you know, first class experience while they're in college in WIT. That's the main goal. And I suppose to have a supportive academic and sporting together is what we hope to achieve.
You mentioned that this isn't necessarily your natural forte. Is it something that you're going to, you know, brush up on and maybe dip your own toe into to try and develop a greater understanding of the needs and the requirements and the challenges that come with esports?
Yeah, I'm learning quickly. I'm learning quickly. And I suppose, first of all, you're kind of looking at the numbers that are involved in it and the amount of people and the scale of it. when we initially announced that I started engaging with Collegiate Esports and Esports Ireland, I was asking the question, will we get applicants? You know, and they were like, the people are out there, you don't understand. We did our launch last Friday. We haven't put it out in public yet, and already we're having inquiries about the scholarship already. So there's obviously a massive appetite out there for it. So I suppose we have great team members who are, I suppose, more up to speed on it than I am, but I'm trying to get myself there very quickly. And I think it's a thing that everybody involved in sport is going to have to get there. Like, it is out there. It's developing very quickly. You see, the NBA have eSport teams, Formula One have eSport teams, Munster Rugby in Ireland. So it is very much so becoming part of normal sport as well. So I think we really have to engage in it.
Brilliant stuff. Well, look, as you said, the full information is up on WIT.ie. But John Windle, the head of WIT Viking Sport, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much, Jess. Thank you.
And that is all we have time for this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full up on newstalk.com. But don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on the Go Loud app in iTunes, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. John Friday's up next here on News Talk. I'll chat to you next week.